Greetings, Sun Sounds listeners, and welcome to the Philosopher Program. This is your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis, and her co-host, Bullet Lewis. And I am happy to report that we have finally received the November-December issue of Science of Mind. And so we'll be sharing much of that in the first half hour of this program to catch up and share some holiday energy. And so we turn to some daily passages from Science of Mind. Daily Guides, Heaven is a Practice, Not a Promise, a Look. And these were written by Reverend Chris Alexander. This month, my inspiration for the Daily Guides came from our quest for authenticity and balance while seeking to be radically gentle and kind. These guides draw deeply from our incredible planet and the theology of eco-spirituality, finding profound lessons in nature that can guide us to set healthy boundaries and create a world that works for all. Reverend Chris Alexander is a meta-minister of Soul Evolution Collaborative, the global themes coordinator for CSL, and the curriculum development specialist for Circles USA. She's a visionary catalyst, pioneering the path of possibility and social transformation through universal principles. As a spiritual alchemist and global change agent, she unapologetically embraces her role as a truth-teller. She dedicates herself to exploring the intersection between the mystical and the mundane, together with the sacred and the profane. With a remarkable ability to hold paradoxes and perceive life from multiple perspectives, she champions the power of honest, love-infused communities. To dive deeper into her insights and explore her body of work, visit her website at revchris.org. A Universe of Trees. Earth is so thick with divine possibility that it is a wonder we can walk anywhere without cracking our shins on altars. Barbara Brown Taylor. In the true perspective, matter is the complement of spirit and necessary to it, and is not unreal at all. And I believe this. God's world is not a world of illusion. Ernest Holmes, The Anatomy of Healing Prayer, page 174.1. I wonder what it's like to be a leaf, spending my life seeking the sun, relishing the rain and blowing gently in the breeze, part of something larger, connected through my stem, my core, my center, yet gently waving on my own. I wonder if leaves love the wind. I wonder if the leaves closest to the trunk have a deeper understanding of oneness, having felt the slight touch of direct connection. I wonder if they spend their lives telling the other leaves about this being, this divine presence they are a part of, that loves them and wants them to flourish. Is crown shyness a moment of respect, a willingness to hold clear boundaries and witness one another from afar? Or is it a form of tribalism, a concern that the other might be dangerous to them? I like to believe it is the former, that leaves teach us the beauty of boundaries when we take the time to look up. What if God, Spirit, the universe, is the trunk, and we are the leaves? Is this universe a single tree in a forest? How expansive would my consciousness need to be to perceive other trees? Do the bacteria living in the trunk know of the existence of other trees? If we are the bacteria of the universe, are we beneficial or harmful? We decide each and every day. I choose to benefit the world I'm in. I choose to make my presence a testament to the universe, to the tree I call home. What will you choose? Affirmation. I expand my consciousness, allowing this broader perspective to guide me in benefiting the planet and all life. I feel at home in the universe and in this body. The sun is present always. This complicated moment on Earth is no time to retreat into the simplistic metaphor of bringing light. The hope we must maintain, the imagination we must put to use, and the physical health we require all ask of us a more intricate wisdom. Linda Lynn Haupt, Rooted, Life at the Crossroads of Science, Nature, and Spirit. God the Divine never had but one son. This son is being born at every season and every place, through all races and in all nations. Every birth is a divine event. Every conception is immaculate. Ernest Holmes, Science of Mind magazine, December 1962, page 48. Today is the winter solstice in the Northern Hemisphere, a time that reminds me of the origins of the Christmas tree. In ancient times, pagans brought evergreens into their homes during winter to brighten their spaces, celebrate the solstice, and remind themselves that the sun would return. I find it meaningful to remember that just as the sun is always present, with its light obscured only by the earth's rotation, Spirit is always within me, even if my perception and awareness fluctuate. Recognizing our inherent wholeness, especially when life feels lacking, such as during the dim light of the winter solstice, can be challenging. Yet wholeness is our true essence, even if it doesn't always manifest as what we deem good. It might sometimes appear as incomplete, messy, painful, or difficult. In such moments, remembering that wholeness equals oneness, and oneness is a spiritual truth, can offer comfort. Perhaps during tough times we can find ways to metaphorically bring in a tree and celebrate the balance of all experiences, trusting in the continuous presence of Spirit within us. What are you reminding yourself of today? Affirmation. I honor the wholeness of my being, recognizing that I encompass both light and dark, joy and pain. And from the Daily Word, published by Unity, Home Blessing. My home is a place of love and harmony. My home is more than a shelter. It is a place of security, a welcoming hub for family and friends, especially during the Christmas season. I bless my home with positive, loving thoughts and prayers of peace and harmony. With each thought, I create a place where guests are comfortable, where all can gather in love and joy. I bless each room, knowing that the love of God flows from wall to wall, radiating welcome and comfort. I bless the doors that welcome everyone who enters and the roof that protects us all. All who enter this dwelling become a part of the harmony that flows throughout. My home invites laughter, goodwill, and security. I pray all who enter feel the love of God, Spirit, the universe that resides here. Light. The light of God, Spirit, the universe within me shines brightly. No matter the amount of darkness that surrounds me, the illumination that comes from the light of God within me shines brightly. This awareness blesses me and helps me maintain my perspective about the shifting state of the world and the changeless nature of God, of Spirit, of the universe. Just as certain times of year are darker than others, certain times of life are dark while others are lighter, yet the light of God is eternal and unchanging. I place my attention on the light of God, of Spirit, of the universe, which shines brightly within me. On my darker days, it is the light that sustains me. During easier times, I shine my inner light into the world and illuminate the way for others. And from Mark Nepo's The Book of Awakening, Having the Life You Want by Being Present to the Life You Have, Believing. Believing is all a child does for a living. Curtis Lamkin. Picasso once said that artists are those of us who still see with the eyes of children. Somehow, as we journey into the world, more and more gets in the way. And we stop questioning things in order to move deeper into them and start questioning as a way to challenge things that we fear are false. As a child, I used to talk to things, birds that flew overhead, trees that swayed slowly in the night, even stones drying in the sun. For years, though, I stopped doing this freely because of what others might think. And then I stopped altogether. Now I learn that Native Americans do this all the time, that many original peoples believe with their childlike eyes right into the center of things. Now, almost 50, I am humbled to recover the wisdom that believing is not a conclusion, but a way into the vitality that waits in everything. When you can, talk with a child about how they see the world. Nowhere to go. There is nothing to do and nowhere to go. Accepting this, we can do everything and go anywhere. One of the basic notions of Taoism is that the world, in all its mystery and difficulty, cannot be improved upon, only experienced. We are asked to believe that life in all its complexity and wonder is complete as is, ever-changing and vital, but never perfectible. I've come to understand that this doesn't prevent our being involved. On the contrary, accepting that the world can do quite fine without us allows us to put down the burden of being corrective heroes and simply concentrate on absorbing the journey of being alive. Thus, our work is not to eliminate or recreate anything. Rather, like human fish, we are asked to experience meaning in the life that moves through the gill that is our heart. Ultimately, we are small living things awakened in the stream, not gods who carve out rivers. We cannot eliminate hunger, but we can feed each other. We cannot eliminate loneliness, but we can hold each other. We cannot eliminate pain, but we can live a life of compassion. I only came upon these notions after experiencing them. Faced with dying, the opportunity to change the world was taken away. It was all I could do to survive being changed by the world. This sent me into a sudden depression, but soon I found what remained to be liberating. Stripped of causes and plans and things to strive for, I discovered that everything I could need or ask for is right here, in flawed abundance. Since then, my efforts have turned from trying to outrun suffering to trying to express it, from trying to achieve joy to trying to discover it, and from trying to shape or better the lives around me to accepting love wherever I can find it. Sit quietly and simply let your heart breathe without focus. Try not to think, and also try not to not think. Exhale your pressures and arrive where you are. Breathe deeply and accept the jewel and grit of this moment. And I feel a Christmas carol coming on. Silent night, holy night, all is calm, all is bright, round yon virgin mother and child, holy infant so tender and mild, sleep in heavenly peace, sleep in heavenly peace. Silent night, holy night, shepherds quake at the sight, glory stream from heaven afar, heavenly hosts sing alleluia, Christ the Savior is born. Christ the Savior is born. We return to Science of Mind for the personal affirmations by Eugene Holden, RSCP. Sticking the landing, standing firm. We always have the opportunity to remember to stand in faith, the kind of faith that knows all is well. Stand firm in knowing that right where you are, God, Spirit, the universe is. I stand boldly in knowing that God is the essence of my being. I'm always guided and directed to experience the highest and best life has to offer. I say yes and thank you. The light. You were created to be light here on earth. How do you do that? By knowing you are the joy of God, of Spirit, of the universe, everywhere you go. Shine your light through your smile. Shine on, my friends. I am the light of the infinite. I shine my light everywhere I go. I light up everyone who comes into my conscious awareness. I am the light of God, of Spirit, of the universe. Flow motion. Surrender is the prerequisite to being in the flow. We must let go of the banks of fear, doubt, and worry to be in flow motion. Let go and allow life to take its natural course through you. I release and I let go. I allow the infinite presence of God full sway in my life. I am the awesome life of God, of Spirit, of the universe. Open, receptive, available. Shining our light calls us to be open, receptive, and available. Be open to allowing the infinite intelligence to live through you and as you. Be receptive of your gifts and talents. Be available for God, for Spirit, the universe, to be great in you. I am open, receptive, and available to live the life of God, of Spirit, of the universe. I stand in the awareness that I am supported in all I do. There is only one life. That life is God, is Spirit, is the universe. I am that life now, and so it is. And I just want to pause for a moment. I haven't reminded us of this in a while, but please substitute when you hear the word God or Spirit or the universe with whatever you call the oneness, the wholeness, the universe, Spirit, God. Fill in your own wording. And in Science of Mind, we turn to Reverend Jane Beach's monthly column, Free to Be, Connection to Everything. Have you ever had a moment when you realized there was more to life than getting up each day, going about your business, and doing it all again the next day? There's something greater going on. In one transformative moment, we can have a sudden shift in consciousness that allows us to see the majesty of the life we are an integral part of. Divine love is you, and it is me. As a glorious child of the One, we're each part of the interconnectedness of all life. The presence of love is alive in the sun rising over the mountains and setting on the horizon. It's the eagle swooping down to catch its breakfast, and the squirrel scurrying up the trunk of a nearby tree. It's the car engine starting for our driving pleasure, and the aroma of freshly brewed coffee. The awareness that I'm connected to everything can happen at any moment. I can be completely transformed as I heal from an illness, delight in hugging a friend, or embrace a new idea. For me, the God of my understanding is in all things, at all times, in every circumstance. My prayer is to feel a divine connection just as I can feel the warmth of the sun's rays. The sun has no judgment about who's worthy of its warmth. It simply shines its light. We humans are a curious bunch. We wonder what gift we can possibly bring to the world, not realizing that we already have within us everything we could possibly need to shine the light we already are. We're here to express our divinity in a way that is unique to us, as only we can do. We have purpose. We belong here. We matter in the world. Today, I'll take time to be fully present in every moment. When I forget the truth of who I am, I'll turn my face toward the sun to remember I can step out of the shadows of my life to feel its warmth. It's a constant reminder that I have within me my own light. And from the same issue, we turn to an article by Marcia Hootman. Where do you want to land? Once you make a decision, the universe conspires to make it happen. Ralph Waldo Emerson. Emerson's words appear on a poster displayed on the walls of many great athletes. Great athletes know that unless they decide and commit to exactly what they want to achieve, including the how and when, they won't succeed. During the Winter Olympics, we see downhill skiers awaiting their turn, sitting quietly with eyes closed. They envision and visualize the run they will soon take. With each turn on the course, even with eyes closed, their heads turn slightly. Similarly, Olympic swimmer Michael Phelps, holder of 23 Olympic gold medals, learned to watch a mental video of his races every night before he went to sleep. Gymnasts, too, mentally go through their whole routine, step by step, leap by leap, many times before they step foot on the mat. The best of the best in every sport know visualization is one step in sticking the landing. Athletes call this rehearsing the performance before their turn in the competition begins. We who study New Thought teachings call it visualization. We create vision boards, meditate on our goals, and trust that spirit will bring our dreams to pass. What we don't remember is that although athletes use the same mental practice, they first decide exactly what they want as the end result. They specifically set their goals. I want to finish this race 3 seconds before my closest competitor. I want to give the best performance of my life. And then they take whatever steps are necessary to accomplish their goals. Steps to success. In first year Science of Mind classes, we learn the steps of spiritual mind treatment. 1. Recognition. 2. Unification. 3. Realization. 4. Thanksgiving. 5. Release. Let's take a closer look at each of these steps. Step 1. Recognition. In The Science of Mind, Ernest Holmes writes, affirmative prayer is a recognition of spirit's omniscience, omnipotence, and omnipresence, and a realization of humanity's unity with spirit. At times, we feel as if we're alone in our desires to be, do, or have something. This first step reaffirms that this is not so. One of the often used phrases in our teaching is, there is a power in the universe greater than we are, and we can use it. That's what recognition means. You may feel as if you are alone, but that's not so. Recognizing the all-encompassing power of spirit can bring a sigh of relief. Step 2, unification. Although we may think the power of God is only outside of us, Holmes reminds us it is also omnipresent. In other words, it's always there, inside and out. Whether you're an athlete, a baker, a writer, or whatever else you choose, you are never alone. Athletes go into an altered state when they compete. When the race is over, they know they didn't succeed alone. When they are in what they call the zone, they know something inside and outside of them is allowing them to succeed. We do the same when we pray or meditate. Step 3, realization. New Thought luminary Neville Goddard wrote, I will is a confession that I am not. Prayer is the art of assuming the feeling of being and having that which you want. Affirmations are a big part of our teachings, but some of us may have a habit of pushing goals out into the future. I will have, I want, I'm going to be. If there is something you want to have in the future, remember to state it in the first person and present tense as if it already is so. As Goddard said, I will is a confession that I am not. There's another sub-step in the science of realization. A common admonition is to pray to God and row the boat to shore. In other words, after deciding what you want, decide what steps you will take to help that happen. Prayer without action, without works, is futile. My office walls are plastered with what we call affirmations. Some are reminders or motivational quotes. Others are goals, wants, and desires. And even though I've been a student of science of mind and a minister for decades, there are times when I look at my wall and realize I can take down one thing or another because it's already happened. Never claim, "I shall be that." Let all claims from now on be, "I am that I am." And take whatever steps are necessary to do what you say you want to do. For example, last summer I woke up one morning and decided I wanted to walk the Camino de Santiago. Pilgrims walk about 10 miles a day for at least a week. I've exercised every day for 40 years, but I've never walked more than maybe a mile at a time. So I began walking more. I joined Camino Facebook groups to read about walkers' preparation and adventures. I researched training programs. It was a daily commitment of 4+ hours for me. With all my interests, golf, writing, counseling clients, and playing music, I don't have an extra 4 hours in my day. That's when I removed all the Camino posters from my walls. Behind every successful athlete, actor, author, or dancer lie hundreds, maybe thousands of hours spent learning and honing their craft. They hold a vision of what they desire and are willing to do whatever it takes to achieve their dreams. At times, their initial dream evolves into an even better outcome. Although what dedicated professionals do may look effortless, you see it that way only because you are not witness to the steps they took to reach their peak performance. Treat and move your feet is not just a fun quote we use, it's a mandate for success. Of course, the first step is to put your desire into the universe, to pray for whatever you desire. But if you're not willing to take the additional steps to get you there, God is not at fault. As we know from James 2:14, faith without works is dead. Step 4, Thanksgiving. Many scientific studies, including several conducted by UCLA, show that grateful people experience less depression and or anxiety, experience less stress, and sleep better, in addition to realizing other health benefits. At times, we all find it difficult to feel grateful, especially after something negative happens. But I believe there is a kernel of good in everything. I've come to realize that waking up every morning is a blessing in itself. You get to discover your own blessings. Look around. Think. There's always something to be grateful for. In affirmative prayer, we thank whatever we call our higher power, God, Spirit, the universe, Jesus, Allah, Mother Nature. Step 5, release. This is probably the most important step in affirmative prayer. We can say we desire some results. We can say we turned our desires over to God, yet we may keep taking it back. Is it happening? Am I really going to achieve this? Did I do this correctly? Release is one of the most important habits to hone in life. Release negative people in our lives. Release resentment. Release doubts. Release fears. And turn all of it over to your higher power. Every champion athlete possesses an intense desire to succeed. If they didn't, they would not spend most of their time perfecting their craft. Be sure what you focus on is your own desire and not what someone else desires for you. And every champion athlete believes that with the proper thoughts, healthy lives, dedicated discipline, and visualization, nothing is impossible. As followers of Science of Mind, we know spirit is not only part of our lives, but spirit makes all things possible. You can stick your landing, whatever that is for you, as long as you commit to naming the vision, taking the steps to get there, and trusting the process. Happy landings! And from this same issue, we turn to Reverend Dr. Andriette Earle's monthly column, From the Inside Out. The G-O-A-T returns. This past summer, I caught Olympics fever. I waited with great anticipation for Simone Biles' return to her Olympic queendom. During the 2020 Tokyo Olympics, Biles, the most decorated gymnast of all time, withdrew from several Olympic gymnastic events after experiencing the twisties. As spectators, we watched as she did not stick her landing and noticed that she also appeared disoriented and unsteady. It turns out that the twisties are a frightening and dangerous predicament for a gymnast. The Cleveland Clinic describes the twisties as a mental block that creates a dangerous disconnect between mind and body while gymnasts are airborne. Suddenly, while airborne, there's a disconnect in the feedback loop. The gymnast loses the mind-body connection, such that they cannot discern where their body is. Biles said she was fighting demons and trying to push past the experience on her own. It took her about 18 months to return to a more normal, consistent practice and ultimately focus on the 2024 Olympics. Finally, she began her redemption tour. After qualifying at the World Championships, Biles was set to compete at the Paris Olympics. She was back. She performed in true GOAT, greatest of all time, form. Possibly the greatest vaulter ever, she successfully executed the finals, earned the highest score, and won the gold medal. In true Biles style, she won a total of 3 golds. Even with a calf injury and a stumble, she still earned a silver medal in the women's floor event. My takeaway? We may not successfully execute and stick our landing with everything we intend to accomplish. It may even appear that we have forfeited our heart's desire. However, if we are blessed to wake up the next day, we have another opportunity to realize our dreams. I find Biles' joy, perseverance, and commitment to untangle her twisties infectious. I watched with glee as she executed the seemingly impossible and demonstrated her mental equivalent. This year, as she flew, flipped, and spun, sticking her landing, I noted the powerful combination of clear intention, infinite possibility, and personal responsibility required in seeking and realizing our greatest yet to be. Deck the halls with boughs of holly, fa la 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 la. 'Tis the season to be jolly, fa la 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 la. Don we now our gay apparel, fa la 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 la. Troll the ancient Yuletide carol, fa la 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 la. See the blazing Yule before us, fa la 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 la. Strike the harp and join the chorus, fa la 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 la. La, follow me in merry measure, fa la 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 la. While I tell of Yuletide treasure, fa la 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 la. Fast away the old year passes, fa la 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 la. Hail the new ye lads and lasses, fa la 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 la. Sing we joyous all together, fa la 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 la. Deck the halls with boughs of holly, fa la 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 la. 'Tis the season to be jolly, fa la 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 la. Don we now our gay apparel, fa la 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 la. Troll the ancient Yuletide carol, fa la 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 la. Happiest of holidays, however you celebrate, as long as you celebrate, enjoy and love. We pause for a moment now to remind you that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of programming from over 300 publications, and you're currently listening to the Philosopher Program with your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis, and her co-host, Bullet Lewis. And if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info and audio/on demand. We continue now with the book we've been reading by Rainn Wilson, Soul Boom, Why We Need a Spiritual Revolution. And we had started Chapter 7, The Fabulous Foundations of Faith. It can be challenging and somewhat misleading to categorize the various religious and spiritual movements that have appeared every 500 to 1,000 years or so under one vast umbrella of worldwide religious movements. At first glance, it feels like Buddhism is nothing at all like Islam, and Judaism couldn't be more divergent from Hinduism. Many faiths are monotheistic, some are polytheistic, and some are divinely agnostic. The karmic religions of the East, for the most part, feel completely and utterly different from the Abrahamic faiths in most every way. Some believe in a form of reincarnation. Others have a central authority, like a pope. Some are as decentralized as one can possibly imagine. Christianity has 45,000 various denominations around the globe. Islam has essentially two main sects. Two that, like Catholics and Protestants of centuries past, often have zero qualms killing each other in their prophet's name. So when trying to reframe religion as a worldwide social movement and a source of progress in the gradual but necessary evolution and maturation of humanity, we need to shift our perspective to a 20,000-foot view. For the purpose of this discussion, let's float up into the atmosphere and take a peep down on the foundational reality of these many historic faiths. Not their many differences, which are often discussed, but their commonalities. These major religions of planet Earth share each of the same spiritual DNA when examined macroscopically, sociologically, evolutionarily. And as different as they may appear, the world's major faith traditions are philosophically bound together in many ways. French sociologist Émile Durkheim was the first to examine religions from this broad perspective. He defined religion as a unified system of beliefs and practices relative to sacred things. There's that sacred word again. Perhaps these disparate religions are all different pathways leading somehow to the same ultimate truth. In what specific ways do they bind together or religio their adherents? Can we boil all the great religious movements that hold over 6 billion of us humans in their membership down to, let's say, 10 essential universal truths that they all hold in common? True, some of these bleed over into one another, and there's tremendous overlap. But nevertheless, I'm going to give it a try. Here's my stab at these universal commonalities. 1. A higher power. 2. Life after death. 3. The power of prayer. 4. Transcendence. 5. Community. 6. A moral compass. 7. The force of love. 8. Increased compassion. 9. Service to the poor. 10. A strong sense of purpose. Disclaimer. An obvious commonality among all the world's major religions is the organization around the message of a central figure, the larger-than-life divine teacher such as Buddha, Krishna, Moses, Christ, Muhammad, or Baha'u'llah, who was revered and who sacrificed his life for the respective messages of inner peace and world love. You know, the OG influences of planetary spiritual transformation. But the existence of a central figure won't be one of the 10 truths we explore. For one, over the centuries, many of these great individuals have become, sadly, divisive figures. And my goal is to focus on the core teachings that emerged through the revelations of these great figures, not the presence of the figure itself. 1. A higher power. Whatever you call it, God, in some way, shape, or form, exists in every religious faith. He comes by many names, but all the world's major religions identify a divine force that is or was or permeates all things. I covered this pretty extensively in Chapter 4, and I don't want to take up any more space or time waxing on about the notorious G-O-D. But I'd like to use this literary real estate to address one specific point in the context of this master list, Buddhism and God. Many point to Buddhism as an example of a religious movement without a central concept of a higher power, but this isn't entirely true. Yes, Buddhists do not worship any supreme being, but in seeking bliss, nirvana, and enlightenment, there's an inherent spiritual force guiding that process. Siddhartha Gautama, a.k.a. the Buddha, proclaims in Udana 8.3 of the Kudaka Nikaya, there is an unborn, an unoriginated, an unmade, an uncompounded were there not, O mendicants. There would be no escape from the world of the born, the originated, the made, and the compounded. This, in my opinion, is another way to describe God without all that pesky Judeo-Christian anthropomorphism. In the Buddhist universe view as I see it, the force is a spiritual juice that makes the salvation of nirvana possible, which is very much in line with Christian philosopher Paul Tillich's definition of God as the ground of all being and with Baha'u'llah's view of God as an unknowable essence. So there it is, the first, somewhat obvious, unifying principle of all religions, a belief in something or someone bigger than creation who is beyond all comprehension. And the benefit of this in a religious context? Humility. To think of the divine source is to feel rightfully small in an expansive universe, a reminder that, despite what our self-obsessed society tells us, the band Kansas was 100% right when they sang, "All we are is dust in the wind. All we are is dust in the wind." 2. Life after death. Every religion has some form of ideology that includes life after this physical life, something I discussed in depth in Chapter 3, but I want to touch on the foundational nature of this concept and how it relates to the roots of religion itself. Remember, the very first proof of humanity's spiritual impulse are burial sites where our ancestors from the Upper Paleolithic era, from about 40,000 to 50,000 years ago until about 10,000 years ago, were buried alongside grave goods they might require for their journey forward into the afterlife: a sword, a map, food, a pet dog, and in the case of King Tut, actual chariots. While the mythologies from various faiths might differ greatly as to what the end is, heaven, happy hunting grounds, nirvana, Zion, Valhalla, all faiths point to the central idea that the end of the physical life is not the end of our journey, that the material world is not the only world. Zoroastrianism, which is more than 3,000 years old and is the incredibly rich foundational source of so many religious and mythological beliefs in both the West and the East, was the first to posit the existence of a fravashi, or what we would call a soul. The soul, created by the greatest god, Ahura Mazda, is immortal and has its resurrection at the time of what is called the Great Renewal. After one dies, the soul is judged immediately. We essentially pass over a bridge, and the good will ascend to the House of Songs, that is, a paradise with angels watching over them, and those who have lived evil lives will be directed to the House of Lies, that is, hell. The Hindu tradition of reincarnation is, I believe, frequently misunderstood. As far as I, a total non-Hindu, understand it, there is a cycle of life and rebirth on the physical plane called samsara. And this cycle continues until one achieves enlightenment, after which there is something called moksha, and the soul is released to be with the Supreme Being. In other words, reincarnation does not go on forever. The ultimate goal and endpoint of reincarnation is a blissful reunion and merging into the oneness of the divine planes of existence. Likewise, in the Buddhist tradition, eventually you step off the wheel of samsara, the cycles of birth, suffering, and death, and enter nirvana. Of course, nirvana is not a three-dimensional space. It is a spiritual realm of selflessness, or no-selfness. In every faith tradition, the idea of a non-material world after this world, one that is a totally blissful reunion with the cosmic universe, is positioned as the end goal. Again, this frames our work and growth here on Earth, as this plane is seen as but a way stop, albeit a crucial one, on the path to far greater spiritual realms and experiences. 3. Power of prayer. All religions have some version of prayer, of supplication to and communion with the divine. Whether mystical, personal, communal, or ceremonial, prayer seeks a dialogue with the profound mystery that both surrounds and surpasses all of us. Perhaps it is having a personal conversation with Jesus, performing dawn devotionals, or lighting incense or candles. Maybe it's chanting, counting prayer beads, group singing, shouting praise, or invoking hymns. Or it might be ecstatic dancing, ringing bells, cleansing ablutions, bowing in a certain direction or a circumambulation. Whatever form it takes, devotional prayer is among the oldest acts of humans on the planet and among the most sacred. The Jewish Siddur prayer book offers many beautiful prayers. The Modeh Ani is recited upon awakening each morning before leaving one's bed. I give thanks before you, King, living and eternal, for you have returned within me, my soul, with compassion. Abundant is your faithfulness. A Hindu prayer begins, "My soul, listen unto me. Love thy Lord as the lotus loves water." Daily obligatory prayers, or salat, are recited 5 times a day by Muslims as they bow in humility toward Mecca. Glory and praise be to you, O Allah. Blessed be your name and exalted be your majesty. There is none worthy of worship except you. Although Buddhism doesn't necessarily subscribe to a creator God, Buddhists nonetheless supplicate to the majesty of the universe with such beautiful prayers as the Metta Prayer and the Golden Chain Prayer. One of my most favorite offerings comes from the Navajo Diné people. In beauty happily I walk. With beauty before me I walk. With beauty behind me I walk. With beauty below me I walk. With beauty above me I walk. With beauty all around me I walk. Indeed, prayer is a core aspect of every religion. It is central to any spiritual journey. As the brilliant Anne Lamott says in her classic book about prayer, Help, thanks, wow, the three essential prayers. So prayer is our sometimes real selves trying to communicate with the real, with truth, with the light. And in this light, we can see beyond our modest receptors to what is way beyond us and deep inside. And prayer means that in some unique way, we believe we're invited into a relationship with someone who hears us when we speak in silence. Lamotte pretty much covers it. Help, prayers of supplication and the begging of assistance for the infinite travails of life. Thanks, prayers of gratitude. And wow, prayers of awe and wonder. Meister Eckhart, the medieval Catholic mystic, echoes this idea. If the only prayer you ever say in your entire life is thank you, it will be enough. Personally, I start every day with this mystical outreach of help, thanks, wow, and my life is all the richer for it. But the best prayers, and the reason I think prayer is such a powerful tool for change, rise above words and chants and transform into tangible acts of love and service. One of my spiritual idols, Oprah Winfrey, says, "As far back as I can recall, my prayer has been the same. Use me, God. Show me how to take who I am, who I want to be, and what I can do, and use it for a purpose greater than myself." And continuing this idea of prayers as action items, Abdu'l-Bahá of the Wise Baha'i Leader memorably said, "Therefore strive that your actions day by day may become beautiful prayers." 4. Transcendence. "There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy." William Shakespeare, Hamlet. On the macro level, religion has helped, for some you might say it's even caused, humanity to transcend being mere organic, animalistic, bio-robots whose behavior is shaped by the rewards and punishments of our environments. Instead, through some core ideals of religious practice, humans have been able to rise above the demands of their genes and evolutionary programming to put community ahead of their selfish interests. All faith traditions urge us toward this type of transcendence. Buddhism encourages meditation to realize that we can not only rise above self, but also come to the realization that we had no self to begin with. Islam especially, through its Sufi form, urges reaching the state of fana, a transcendental selflessness. In the Hindu holy text, the Bhagavad Gita, transcendence is described as a level of spiritual attainment in which one is no longer under the control of materialistic or animalistic desires. When scholars of the positive psychology movement, Christopher Peterson and Martin Seligman, searched the major holy books and philosophical texts of humanity for universal virtues, one of the six they identified was transcendence. The other five are wisdom, courage, love, temperance, and justice. Those psychologists considered the basic human trait of transcendence to include the character strengths of spirituality, or sense of purpose, appreciation of beauty, gratitude, humor, and hope. Remember Plato's famous allegory of the cave? Human beings are chained to chairs facing a stone wall, unable to turn around. Behind them, there glows a great light from a fire in an even greater reality that exists outside the mouth of the cave. Between the fire and the backs of the people in their chairs are other folks carrying miscellaneous objects, dancing, and using shadow puppets. The chained humans watch the flickering shadows dancing on the stone wall, like a movie, convinced that that is reality, when in fact there is far greater truth, beauty, and actual life just outside of the reach of our perception. This idea that there are realms of mystery, truth, and glory just beyond our vision, that we are intimately connected to these realms, and that it is part of our journey to eventually partake of them, is inherent in some way, shape, or form to all the religions of the past. In most all faith traditions, we are not just our bodies, minds, or feelings. Reality is not just stuff. There are realms invisible to the eye to be perceived only by spiritual means, and part of our sojourn in this glorious, infuriating land of mud is a longing for the transcendence radiating from the light outside the mouth of the cave. This is a profound idea that can unify humans around the idea that there is more to life than the sometimes tedious day-to-day pursuit of pleasure, status, comfort, and the obtaining of stuff. 5. Community. What is a community? According to Merriam-Webster, it is a unified body of individuals. The definition continues, people with common interests living within a particular area. People with common interests? explains why early communities were simply extended family in a cave. But eventually, that definition gradually evolved to local village, to tribe, to city, to general geographic area, to nation, to people, race. And then there's religion, a way to bind folks together in some never-before-seen ways. It was no longer what village or family or even people you hailed from. It was what you believed. Social cohesion was created by the rituals, worship, and ceremonies adherents collectively engaged in, plus a shared set of ethics and a common sacred mythology. What bound us was no longer solely based on genetics, familial affiliations, or ancestry. Religious communities allow the communal love to go far deeper than the familial, or rather, it extends the concept of family to fit a larger vision. It binds us and bonds us while giving perspective through life's most difficult transitions, including marriage, birth, and death. It allows a witnessing of a common divine spark within diverse believers, creating a commonality on a transcendental level. But more important than these factors, there's a set of behavioral consistencies that emerge from a group of people focused on the same collective mindset, a common purpose, mission, and sense of meaning that creates inner peace and social stability. Evolutionary biologists have even suggested that religion was naturally selected because it was so successful in building communities in which everyone cared for each other, thus increasing the survival rate of adherents. Picture, if you will, colorful Hindu festivals filled with joyful celebration, Buddhist monks deep in the stillness of contemplation, the ecstatic whirling dervishes of the Sufi tradition, raucous, praise-filled Baptist choirs lifting the entire congregation, sacred indigenous American sweat lodges or sun dances, Muslim pilgrims encircling the Kaaba in glorious submission, Jews sitting Shiva after a death, being lovingly visited, with food, by countless members of the local temple. The Sikh concept of langar, which creates a vibrant communal table open to folks of every caste and societal class at every Sikh temple, a practice that expands to encompass feeding the poor and destitute. This is how community feels, how it works, what it provides, and to a large extent, what is increasingly missing from our fractured postmodern lives. Today, we often find community not in a town hall or a church, but rather online. Church membership in the United States has plummeted, and instead of filling pulpits, we now log onto screens to find our village. On Reddit message boards, for instance, there are subreddit communities for whatever interests or passion you might have, be it squeaky toy collections, Alabama socialists, or foot fetishism. These odd assemblages feel like community due to sharing similar interests, but the intimate bonding, trust, and camaraderie can frequently be lacking. New York Times political and cultural commentator David Brooks, in his recent magnificent book, The Second Mountain, The Quest for a Moral Life, says of this shift to online community, living online often means living in a state of diversion. When you're living in diversion, you're not actually deeply interested in things. You're just bored at a more frenetic pace. Such is life in the dizziness of online freedom. Nobody quite knows where they stand with one another. Everybody is pretty sure that other people are doing life better. When a whole society is built around self-preoccupation, its members become separated from one another, divided and alienated, and this is what has happened to us. Again, it is completely understandable that modern man has jettisoned organized religion, but have we thrown the baby of our community out with the proverbial bathwater of faith? Also, does that sentence even make sense? 6. A moral compass. Nobody likes morals. Yuck. No one wants to be told about what's right and wrong, especially these days. We in the modern Western world want to be free to do what we want, where we want, when we want. And we certainly don't want any judgmental church lady, ancient dusty book, or moralistic clerk lecturing us on what is good or bad, right or wrong. That being said, morality and ethics are everywhere and inescapable. You simply don't go into a Starbucks and just grab any drink off the counter. You don't cut someone off and slip into the parking space that they've been inching toward. And this is for my son, Walter. If you're reading this, you don't grab someone's remote and change the channel while they're in the middle of watching their show. What seems to be happening in contemporary society is that universal morals, ideas about what is essentially right and wrong, are being continually downgraded and degraded for ever-shifting socially constructed ethics and mores. Here's an example that I hope illustrates what I'm describing. In politics, there used to be a measure of civility that arose from a greater historical sense of basic human decency. There are basic time-honored precepts that one should be kind and respectful and never call people names. I mean, didn't our moms and kindergarten teachers tell us not to? But now we find that the political parties in America, both of which claim to be inspired by Christian values, find it perfectly okay to label political enemies with insults and crass nicknames. Every day we see politicians exhort each other, taunt, mock, and name-call other public servants. And not only has this become acceptable, it is lauded as a show of strength and real leadership. In other words, what historically was seen as grotesque bullying is now commonplace. This behavior has moved from the never do this, it's not right column to the this is now awesome column because social ethics have trumped basic universal rights and wrongs. In this scenario, the ends justify the means. Civility be damned. As long as the right team wins, it doesn't matter how immorally, divisively, and cruelly a candidate or campaign behaves. This lack of civility in public life has been largely fueled by the increasing use of the internet and social media. People are bullying, mean, and derisive in ways they would never be in real life. We see racism, sexism, and general cruelty being expressed on the web in ever-increasing volumes. From the vantage of a spiritual framework, the fundamental reason one does not mock, bully, and call other people names is because, besides it as being unkind, it is not good for the development of the soul, nor is it in emulation of the great spiritual teachers and leaders, Jesus, the Buddha, Muhammad. Such behavior does not bring us closer to the divine will, and it is not in alignment with the great cosmic creative spirit of the universe. What faith communities throughout history have provided their adherents is the idea that there is a higher sense of right and wrong, a list of shared values that comes from a timeless vision, from an ancient soul place, a horizon of what is just and acceptable, from the divine source even. When universal moral frameworks accede to acceptable current societal ethics, to quote William Butler Yeats, the center cannot hold. Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Barbara Tuchman, author of the amazing The March of Folly, From Troy to Vietnam, once said, "Have nations ever declined from a loss of moral sense rather than from physical reasons of the pressure of barbarians? I think that they have." Now, there's a much more complicated and nuanced conversation to be had about morality and ethics, far too complex for us to get into here. And I certainly don't mean to imply that society's moral decay, frequently shouted from pulpits, the mouths of reactionary pundits, and the political campaigns of the world, means any kind of return to the good old days of slavery, sexism, colonialism, and patriarchy. But there's a balance between ethics and morality on one side and individual rights, freedoms, and choice on the other that seems crucial to societal development, and we humans haven't quite figured out that give and take yet. Perhaps there are clues to be found as we keep unearthing ancient wisdom from deep in our historical bedrock. We can still listen to our conscience and access our modern ethical rationality, but ultimately religious morality is not just church ladies, thou shalt's, and Sharia law. It can provide the universal scales upon which to weigh the promptings of our hearts and the occasional faultiness of our reasoning. 7. The force of love. The strongest spiritual practices begin with one quality, love. Unconditional love for self, for our human brothers and sisters, for God. Let's see what some of the greatest mystics and poets of all time have to say about it. "This is my commandment, that ye love one another as I have loved you." Jesus. "This is love, to fly toward a secret sky, to cause 100 veils to fall each moment, first to let go of life, finally to take a step without feet." Rumi. "What we love, we shall grow to resemble." Bernard of Clairvaux. "Love is the only reality. It is the ultimate truth that lies at the heart of creation." Rabindranath Tagore. "Love is all you need." The Beatles. That pretty much sums it up. The indigenous Arctic natives are said to have dozens of words for snow. It is said that in Sanskrit, there are 96 words for love. But in contemporary American English, anything that is vaguely associated with a warm feeling is given the moniker love. It can be romantic in nature, friendly feelings, common affection, or even in place of the word like. It's a generalized umbrella feeling that covers all positive relations. I love my car. I love my dog. I love Sunday mornings. I love my wife, my infant son. I love water skiing. I love pumpkin spice lattes. I love humanity. That's pretty messed up, especially for a culture that prides itself on the majesty, history, flexibility, and poetry of its great language. English has more words than any language in the history of humanity, but we really dropped the ball on words for love. It should be noted that in Klingon there are zero words for love, only kwamsusha, which directly translates to unhate. I kwamsha you, I unhate you, just FYI. Search the holy texts and you'll find some far more interesting words that orbit the concept of love. In the Hebrew scriptures, God's nature again and again is described with the word hesed. The word comes from an idea of bowing one's head to another and roughly translates to steadfast love, covenant love, mercy, and especially loving kindness. We are blessed and grateful because God's love for us is chock full of hesed. And we must end with another quick Christmas carol. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer had a very shiny nose, and if you ever saw it, you would even say it glows. All of the other reindeer used to laugh and call him names. They never let poor Rudolph join in any reindeer games. Then one foggy Christmas Eve, Santa came to say, Rudolph, with your nose so bright, won't you guide my sleigh tonight? Then how the reindeer loved him as they shouted out with glee, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, you'll go down in history. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer had a very shiny nose, and if you ever saw it, you would even say it glows. All of the other reindeer used to laugh and call him names. They never let poor Rudolph join in any reindeer games. Then one foggy Christmas Eve, Santa came to say, Rudolph, with your nose so bright, won't you guide my sleigh tonight? Then how the reindeer loved him as they shouted out with glee, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, you'll go down in history. As always, I wish you a beautiful, joyous, and peaceful new week, and I look forward to being with you next time on our Philosopher program.